right. While everyone's kind of coming in, here's just a look at what remains on the agenda. We're halfway home. I hope you enjoyed lunch. We'll kick things back off here with our the common exam findings and hearing from some members, this time from the swap dealer perspective. Again, we'll have one more break before we close for the day, but we'll keep things rolling on schedule here. So, Shuna, I'll pass it over to you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Shuna Awang, and I am an exam director in the SWAP group. And I'll let my colleague, Zilla, introduce herself.
Good afternoon. I'm Zilla Bratman. I'm a senior manager in the O2C derivatives group overseeing our swap dealer examination.
Thank you, Zilla. So this session will cover the swap dealers. We have two segments for this session. First, Zilla and I will talk about exam findings. Oh. Maybe.
Well, okay. Yeah. Okay.
First, Zilla and I will talk about exam findings and some best practices that we have come across in our exams. We'll focus on the topics that have been important over the past year. One is trade surveillance. As many of you are aware, we have included this area in all of our exams. This is because it is a critical function that firms have in place to comply with business conduct standards. Trade surveillance is only one aspect. There's also employee communications, the monitoring of employee communications. However, we have another panel following this that will talk about employee communications. One area that we'll also focus on is swap data reporting, because we see that this is still a challenging area for many firms. Thirdly, we'll discuss NFA's Interpretive Notice 1977 on the use of marketing material. This became effective only in 2021, and we have been examining it over the past year. After we provide our update on exam findings and best practices, we'd be happy in the second segment to have two compliance officers from our swap dealer members join us. They will share their insights about how to prepare for an NFA exam and beyond. And I hope many of you will learn something from this panel. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Zilla to talk about trade surveillance.
Thank you, Shuna, for that intro. So as Shuna just mentioned, firms rely on trade surveillance to comply with the business conduct standards general provisions. So the general provisions require firms to have policies and procedures to ensure compliance with the relevant subpart. In particular, the rule that prohibits fraud, manipulation, and other abusive practices. So the expectation here is that the policies and procedures are reasonably designed to mitigate the risks at your particular firm. And we recognize that this looks different amongst our different firms. So when it comes to common findings in this area, the most straightforward one that we continue to see is gaps in the surveillance program. So this can range from failure to capture an entire asset class or a failure to capture one particular product within an asset class. We've sort of seen both ends of that spectrum on our exams. So the main takeaway here is that we expect that your trade surveillance program not only covers all asset classes that you trade in, but all products as well. And as part of our exams, we do look at trade data, and we do look at your different surveillance scenarios, and we'll do that comparison. If we see any products that don't seem to be included, we are going to question that. So, you know, relatively straightforward thing to keep in mind. Another component here is system coverage. So ensuring that all of the trading systems that you're using are actually feeding into whatever surveillance tool you're using, whether it's an automated tool or if you're using some other type of alternative method. And the last point we wanted to make related to this bullet is the topic of outages, right? So we know that outages can occur. Sometimes certain trades won't feed into your surveillance tool. The expectation here is that once the outage is identified and the relevant trades are identified, you should retroactively run them through the scenario. So a common issue we see here is an outage has been reported, and then when we start to question what was done around it, nothing. That's where the real issue lies. So we expect you to sort of run those trades through the workflow retroactively. Moving on to the next bullet, another issue we see is the failure to review an adequate population of trades or relying only on a trade reconstruction to try to satisfy the surveillance requirements. So when determining what method of surveillance is appropriate for your firm, volume and risk should drive the method that you decide to go with. Automated surveillance is expected most of the time because, there's a lot of high trading volume at a lot of our firms. However, other methods can still be utilized if volume in a particular product is low. But the big thing we want to emphasize here is doing like a periodic trade reconstruction is not enough to perform surveillance. And this is because a trade reconstruction, the purpose of it is not really to identify market abuse or manipulation. You know, like while we think it's a great exercise to ensure that your trade flow is working properly, it doesn't fulfill the goal of trade surveillance. The next issue we wanted to highlight is the failure to dedicate enough resources to your surveillance program. So for example, not being able to review or dispose of all of your alerts in a timely manner. This could be, due to not having adequate staffing, or also accumulating a material backlog of alerts. Both of these evidence that appropriate resources are not being dedicated to the program. And similarly, we've also seen failure to dispose of alerts with sufficient documentation to support the rationale or outcome that was made, or a failure to readily provide such documentation as part of our routine examinations. If we see insufficient documentation, this will raise questions on the quality of the work that was done to dispose of the alerts, and quite often, insufficient documentation is a result of inadequate policies and procedures. So now that I've covered some of the common findings, I will now discuss some of the, good or better practices that we see and, hope that you'll take away. So the first one is in regards to policies and procedures. So procedures should lay out the documentation standards, and most importantly, they should accurately reflect what's actually in place. Sometimes we'll read a procedure, and then in discussion, we hear that a completely different process is being followed. So firms firstly need to make sure that their procedures are accurate and reflective of what's actually going on at the firm, and then focus on ensuring that these procedures are being followed. The next one is in regards to surveillance technology. So as we've kind of already spoken about this morning, the technology continues to evolve. 10 years ago, no one was really doing automated voice surveillance. Fast forward to today, it's a pretty common practice. Some vendors, keep offering new technology, which they claim will make surveillance even more effective. And we engage with these vendors all the time, so we know what's being offered out there. So I'll just highlight some examples that we've seen recently. So we do see trade surveillance and communication surveillance being combined and done in tandem instead of reviewing just one in a silo. Another one is surveilling across products. So for example, looking at swaps and futures products together in the same scenario to look for cross-product manipulation. Another one is the use of algorithms to focus on market impact and to try to reduce the number of false positives. So these are just a couple that we wanted to highlight for common practices that are out there. But what's important here is while it's good to explore new technology and more sophisticated technology, we do want to emphasize that the appropriate due diligence is done around the vendors because at the end of the day, the responsibility to perform adequate surveillance does lie with the firm. And with respect to more sophisticated surveillance, there becomes an even greater need for the data to be accurate because this really becomes critical at deriving these patterns that you're looking for. So some things to keep in mind here, surveillance logic needs to be tested to ensure that the alerts are being created as they're intended. And similarly, the thresholds need to be carefully evaluated. Obviously, everyone is looking to reduce false positives, but firms need to carefully consider if the level of alerts is reasonable for a particular scenario. Seeing something that's producing very little or no alerts is also concerning. And lastly, if your surveillance tool uses models, we expect that the models would be incorporated into the firm's model risk management program. To wrap up this bullet, we just wanted to emphasize again that as firms and vendors employ more sophisticated surveillance, we want to keep in mind that the proper due diligence is being done. So this is a good time to look back at our third-party service provider interpretive notice, which requires a certain level of due diligence, which would definitely be applicable here. The last bullet pertains to the functions that are involved in surveillance reviews. So compliance personnel should be experienced individuals who are reviewing these alerts. They need to be able to challenge the front office personnel. In the event that there are less experienced individuals conducting these reviews, there needs to be appropriate training in place, there needs to be quality assurance programs in place, and there needs to be proper supervision. This becomes even more important when, once again, you bring more sophisticated technology into play. This is because reviewing and interpreting the results may require more technical expertise. And another observation that we're seeing here is more firms using a first line of defense for performing surveillance. And these are individuals that are not involved in trading, but they do oversee front office activities, and they do report up through the front office business line. So the advantage here is that the individuals tend to have a front office background, so they could have some better expertise to review the alerts. But on the flip side, the risk is their independence. So in these cases, we do expect compliance as the second line to be, sufficiently engaged and heavily involved in these reviews. So for example, we see the second line doing some sample testing and comparing results with the first line. So that wraps up my prepared remarks on surveillance. I'm happy to take any questions.
One over here. Bear with me.
So in instances where you have more of a first-line control doing the surveillance, what would you then expect compliance's role to be in terms of oversight over that, sampling of that? Are they looking at things like patterns, trends, or would there be an expectation that they recreate some of that surveillance?
At a minimum, we would definitely expect to see them involved in items that are being escalated. And just for the reviews that are being routinely closed out, we would expect to see some sort of, like I mentioned, either a QA process or a sample review to make sure that they're comfortable with the reviews that are going on.
Hi, can I ask the opposite of that? What would you expect the first line in a little more depth to be doing?
Could you clarify that?
In terms of frontline supervision, what would be your expectation separate from the second line?
So I think the first question was for scenarios when the frontline are the ones that are reviewing the alerts. So they're essentially performing the function of the surveillance team.
So we have seen more and more firms actually employing first line of defense to look at trade surveillance alerts. And like Zilla mentioned, the advantage is that these individuals tend to come from front office backgrounds. And I do think they have the advantage because they could understand what a trade is saying and more able to challenge or criticize it. This is even more important when things get escalated. You must involve people with sufficient expertise to make the right determination. Now, and I think Mike earlier this morning talked about innovation and technology, and we also still mentioned that we are meeting with various vendors, and they are becoming more sophisticated. The more sophisticated the technology becomes, I think you also have your compliance, so first line, whether it's the first line or second line, to be able to read the output and to interpret the data together with market data to determine whether there is a positive or a concern that needs to be addressed. The bottom line is I think the expertise is important, but also a line of independence is also important.
Just for clarity, when we're talking about surveillance, okay, are we talking about trade settlement? So what I'm trying to say is, are we looking at exchange-traded swap arrangements, or are we looking at maybe the exchange futures settlement slash physical cash settlement, and you're still keeping a tab of all these, so the back office should combine all this together when you do your evaluation or your report for an auditing purposes?
We're talking about trade surveillance for OTC derivative products. So, you know, we're referring to the vendors that are out there that offer surveillance specifically for these product types, which review different types of potential manipulative scenarios like spoofing, wash trading, layering. And these tools generate alerts that someone at the firm will be reviewing and disposing of.
Hi. You mentioned the use, if models are used, that they should be included in the model risk program. Does that include, is that only applicable if it's an internal trade surveillance platform or if we're using a vendor too?
So definitely if it's internal. If you're using a vendor, that's when you'd have to determine what's the due diligence that you can do, right? Like what type of output that you get, can you get from them to get comfortable with how they're, you know, reviewing their models. That's when I would refer back to something like the third-party service provider interpretive notice to see what types of different due diligence you could do to become comfortable that the vendor is doing that.
I'd also like to emphasize that early trade surveillance was really rule-based, but we're seeing more and more moving from rule-based to algorithms or the use of models, and therefore, you know, as compliance folks, you should recognize that it is the model and that it is also incorporated into the firm's risk management program, because that's something that we definitely will be looking at when we do future exams.
Yeah, you mentioned expectations around incorporating new technologies like automated voice surveillance. Are those expectations aligned with the size of the firm, the trading, or?
Yes, I think it's safe to say all of these expectations align with the size of the firm. You know, if it's a large volume, obviously it's not really feasible to listen to these recordings manually, right? That's when you really need to consider having an automated tool. But if it's low volume and it's possible to listen to all of them or sample, then that's reasonable. So it just has to make sense for the size of your firm and your business. Any other questions on surveillance? If not, then Shuna will continue with reporting. Okay, one more question.
I guess to that same point, is there an expectation from NFA as far as like how often you're sort of considering these advances of surveillance technology? Like, what is your expectation of firms when they are considering, you know, whether their surveillance technology may be a little outdated or anything like that?
So we do think that this should be an ongoing conversation at the firm, right? It's hard to keep up nowadays. We're not saying that we expect that every time we come around, your program needs to look different, but you need to sort of be able to explain. Like, if I think it's important to stay in these industry discussions to hear what other firms are doing to make sure that you're not becoming an outlier. So I think it should really always be a topic of conversation.
And I think that's how we sort of gauge what is reasonable. You know, we do exams across swapulas, and it includes very, very big swapulas to very small swapulas, right? So we tried to benchmark practices across similar size firms to try to have a reasonable approach. And as Zilla mentioned, we know that many of you talk. You talk about what's going on. You talk about NFA exams, I know. So continue talking and, you know, learn about what each other's doing and, you know, think about whether it sounds good and whether it's something you bring forward to your firm.
One more.
Can you comment on any distinctions by registrant type? Are your comments on trade surveillance only within the context of registered swap dealers? How would they apply to swaps-only IBs?
So this right now we're just focused on swap dealers. But I think the guidelines we have talked to should apply to any sort of surveillance generally, but our findings and our recommendations is solely based on our observations of swap dealers.
Okay, thank you for those questions. Next, we'll move on to swap data reporting. So over the past year, we focused our SDR testing on the new CFTC requirement that became effective at the end of 2022. So the rule requires a swap dealer to reconcile open positions on its internal records to what is maintained at an SDR. This reconciliation should be done every 30 days. If you have an error that is not remediated within 7 days, it is required to be reported to DMO. The objective of the rule is really to ensure the completeness and the accuracy of the data that is reported to the SDR. I think everyone knows if you can't do much with data if it's not good data. So that's the objective here. So with respect to this specific requirement, the findings we have identified included, one, late implementation. A few firms were late in implementing a set of policies and procedures to comply with the new requirements. That is, when we started our exams, there was not a reconciliation in place. The message we have here is that we expect firms to meet the effective dates for compliance. Once an effective date has passed, it can be subject to an NFA exam. It can be effective. We could go the day after and do an NFA exam. However, we are reasonable. The longer or the duration of non-compliance is a factor in the severity of the finding. But also keep in mind that a late implementation could also raise questions about the CCO's ability to administer policies and procedures as required under CFTC 3.3. So focus on meeting effective dates. It just opens up a window for overall criticism. Another finding that we have is that all fields that are required to be reported to an SDR were not reconciled. The rules were very clear. It states, compare all swap data for each open position for which it is the reporting counterparty. A number of firms were doing reconciliations prior to the rule being effective, but it was focused only on primary economic terms. Focusing only on primary economic terms is not compliant with the rules. The third finding we have
is that notifications were not provided to DMO or were not provided timely. Errors are required to be escalated as soon as technologically as practicable. And if not corrected, it has to be reported within 7 days of discovery. An error is considered discovered when a verification process began. We suggest that you fine-tune your verification process to reduce false positives, which will allow you more time to identify true exceptions. What we have seen is that there's a huge number of errors, and many of these are false positive, but by the time you get through to the true errors, 7 days have gone. So that ends my prepared remarks on SDR, and we can take any questions. Oh, no, I have best practices.
Best practices, yeah.
I'm ready for questions. Okay, hold on. So here are some what I think. And these come really from a mixture of exam findings and things that have been self-reported to us. So historically, firms have prioritized SDR work on vanilla products because of the high volume being traded and the potential for bigger reporting issues. However, over the past year, we have seen some cases of misreporting in non-vanilla products, where non-compliance spanned months or even years, involving thousands or even millions of trades. We are therefore recommending, advising, put more focus on more complex products, now that you probably have the vanilla products, you know, more or less correct. Look again at what fields are required by the rules versus what is actually being reported. Your monthly reconciliations will not identify required fields that are missing if they were not reported in the first place. Some firms have employed third-party vendors to also do reconciliations. This could help identify errors, but also keep in mind that NFA has interpretive notice regarding third-party due diligence. And if you use a third party, there must be a proper due diligence. Another good practice we'd like to bring to your attention is in regards to valuations. Quite often, for valuations or reconciliations of valuations, firms compare valuations in the reporting engine versus the SDR. However, what is in the reporting engine may not actually be in the books and records. And this is because there is some manipulation that occurs in the reporting engine. So, for example, your reporting engine may use multipliers for currencies. And we have seen a case where an incorrect multiplier was used in the reporting engine, causing the data to be reported to the SDR to be significantly misvalued, while the data in its internal records was correct. Another recommendation we have is with respect to system changes. Again, this has been a cause for a number of misreporting. A number of firms reported errors after the CFTC rewrite due to problems with the implementation of the rewrite. Some of these resulted in messages not being sent to reporting systems or even downstream, for example, not sending daily marks out. While you have a system implementation change, it is normal that your IS or your technology group performs a lot of due diligence and testing. What we are recommending is for compliance to pay attention to when these system changes are occurring, and depending on the nature of the changes, focus your subsequent testing after these implementations to ensure to provide an extra layer of assurance. Lastly, the recommendation I have is regards to manual booking. It is still a reason why many firms are not meeting Part 43 timeliness. We know that firms are monitoring this, and we are urging you to continue to monitor because we are still seeing issues. As you monitor, consider the timeliness. Some products, as we recognize, will take longer to book. If you are seeing cases where you're taking longer than 15 minutes, you need to become comfortable and be able to support your position that these products will take longer than 15 minutes, because we will ask you to justify it. So with that, I'll just conclude. I think two important things that will help SDR. I do believe the internal reconciliation is important. And I also think if you pay attention to system changes, you know, this will help mitigate any really significant misreporting. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Just a quick question on how you define an error. And that's an error that needs to be subsequently reported within the 7-day period to DMO. Do you consider a missed report to be some omission of report to fit within the definition of an error? So for whatever reason, when you're doing a reconciliation, you notice that there's actually missed reports. Is that then subject to the subsequent reporting to DMO that, well, there was an entire missed report on a specific, you know, product or day?
So the rules, if you're doing the reconciliation, the new rules that came out is focused around the once every 30 days reconciliation. So if during that reconciliation you identify an error, meaning you've reconciled all the data fields in your open position to the DTCC and you recognize what you reported was incorrect, that is an error that needs to be addressed as part of either being remediated within 7 days or reported to DMO within after 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Can you wait for your mic? So, sorry.
So then just to clarify, so if there's a missing report, would that be considered an error?
A missing field, for example?
Could be a missing field. It could be an entirely
yes,
missed
that's
report.
Correct. Okay. Yes.
Hi there. Just a question on the third bullet there. So you're talking about due diligence around implementation of system changes. Are you solely talking about due diligence around third-party service providers, or are you saying that there are issues you found within the due diligence process, even in internal systems and issues?
It can be both. So this is addressing any new system that's implementing or any coding changes to systems. Quite often when firms are rolling out new versions or adding new systems, there's normally a life cycle system development plan that goes through. And there's normally a lot of due diligence to make sure that, you know, the systems continue to talk to each other as expected and the outputs continue to be as expected. Now, you could have this with your internal systems or with the implementation of a vendor system. So I would say it's both.
Hi, my question is whether the NFA has a point of view with regard to certain types of product reporting where the entire industry has issues in how to report that product correctly. I'm not talking about using a proper UPI. I'm talking about things like designating something as a package or properly designating something as a post-price swap or things like that, where the industry is still struggling to identify the best way to do that. I mean, I have other examples, but those are good enough.
Subbeat reporting is very complex. And so it's even us, when a subbeater comes to us and says, you know, ask us these type of very specific questions, we don't have the answer at our fingertips. What we have to do is collaborate among ourselves and also reach out to CFTC to get guidance when needed. I know it doesn't answer your question, but if you have specific questions, because it is so nuanced depending on the type of product it is, and you recognize it's an industry matter, I would recommend, you know, maybe reaching out to the CFTC DMO to get guidance. At least it helps kind of bring this awareness and that you're trying to comply, but you need some guidance.
Yeah. Also to bring it to the relevant SDR also, because they're the ones who put out the specs.
I'm trying to talk louder for everybody's sake. Or if people close to me, that is the default housing that we're question becomes, will you
treat that as a finding?
So what our job is to look at the written rules, right? And if based on our written rules, it is a non-compliance item, you know, it has to be treated as such. Now, we could, you know, depending on the severity or how widespread or the severity of it, sometimes it can be in the report. Sometimes it will not be in the report. It's a management point. So I think it becomes a sort of a fact and circumstance how we deal with it. But we try to, I think if the firm is upfront and show and demonstrates that they have been struggling with trying to figure out how to do this and they've reached out, you know, there will be an internal discussion. And I think it's the firm's advantage to show that they've been trying to comply. And, you know, I don't think we would be draconian with that respect, right? It sort of helps you.
As you have been discussed, there's a lot of issues around especially non-vanilla products and manual bookings. And in that regard, I'm wondering if the NFA has a view on perhaps extending the general 15-minute threshold. I think even 20 or 25 would be very helpful to a lot of firms.
We don't set the 15.
Oh,
the
I know.
Industry did.
Yeah.
We just hold you to your benchmark. We try to be reasonable, honestly. You know, a lot of firms get it within seconds, right? It's some products, commodities, equities probably take longer, right, because it takes time. But we cannot give you a free buy and say, okay, commodities, you're free, all 15. Commodities can be booked within minutes, too. So that's why I say, look at your timing, look at the product. Can you justify why something is taking 30 minutes? Okay, so I think...
one more question.
Running
okay. On the timeliness point, I was wondering if you could provide a little bit of your view on, in the event that things are taking longer to book, just, you know, because of the nature of the trade being more complex or something like that, you know, I think from a compliance officer standpoint, the guidance that I've given is, like, in that instance, you would need to kind of reset your timestamp and have it kind of reflect when the trade was actually executed. I'm curious if you have a view or can provide some guidance on, like, is your expectation that that's done in all cases, like, no matter how long it's taking you to book a trade, or in instances where it's done right away but takes, like, a minute or two and might be just different than what appears on an e-communication or like, you know, voice trade, is there like an acceptable like threshold or level of like, you know, reasonableness to kind of balance having to touch the timestamp on every single trade versus having it match with your, you know, other kind of data points that show when it was executed in the market?
I think I should have said we'd like easy questions. look, I know there's a time gap between the chat of the execution done versus the time of input, and that's why we encourage you to make sure that it gets in as soon as possible. And you, the only way to address this is to keep monitoring it, and where you know improvements can be made, put the pressure to make the improvements, right? But when you know that, hey, you have a commodity that has 30 legs, for example, and it's going to take me time, just continue to monitor. I mean, what we, so the rules, you know, didn't say 30 minutes, didn't say 50 minutes, it says as soon as technologically as practicable, right? And we try to make sure that you're doing, being diligent in trying to get things in as soon as possible. I mean, we just need to see the diligence and the reasonableness of how we're performing against others. We don't input ourselves, so we could only benchmark against your peers.
Hi. So you mentioned make sure that there's monitoring mechanisms in place. So I, for example, am in internal audit. So if I see that the business and second line have monitoring controls to detect when trades are late, is that good enough from an audit perspective, or will in the next NFA exam we will be dinged for still continuing to have leads, even though they are being reported upwards? I'm just trying to understand the balance of effective monitoring.
I just want to make sure I understand the question. So you said that you're aware, like the firm is tracking the lateness, so does that mean you're not going to get a finding that you have late reporting?
Yeah, that they're actively, they have metrics, KPIs, to count how many trades are late each month.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that's definitely great. We want to see that the firm is monitoring for that. We also do our own testing for timeliness, so we're going to compare our results to yours. This is an area where we know that we're not going to get 100% compliance, so it's really all about reasonableness. You know, depends on the products that are driving the lateness. We know, like Shuna mentioned, some may take longer to book, so that's definitely something that we're going to consider. So, you know, long story short, there's no clear answer. It really depends on the figures that we're seeing that, you know, that we have to discuss and sort of assess to come to a conclusion.
It's good that you're monitoring, but you also have to be comfortable that you're happy with what you're seeing.
Right. Yeah, we would assess the reasonableness of volumes and the time range and the fact that they're reporting it upwards. So from an audit perspective, I would be comfortable. I would have to get comfortable with their methodology.
Yeah, you'd have to get comfortable with whether it's reasonable for the firm to take half an hour to report a swap, a vanilla swap, for example, right?
Okay, so during the NFA exams, that oversight and monitoring will be factored in if there are late before an issue is raised.
We will look critically at the lateness of reporting.
Okay.
Okay, so I'd like to move on to marketing because we do have two guests who are eager to have up join us. So the third area that we focused on is marketing materials. So NFA issued an interpretive notice on the use of marketing material, which was effective May of 2021. Our exams over the past couple of years has shown that some firms have not been diligent in implementing procedures that allow full compliance with the interpretive notice. Many firms had pre-existing policies and procedures for marketing material, but our interpretive notice has specific requirements that firms need to implement in order to be fully compliant. Some of the issues we identify include written policies and procedures that did not address all elements of the notice. For example, the frequency of training was not documented in the written policies and procedures. Our interpretive notice does not mandate what the frequency is, but it clearly states that it must be provided in the written policies and procedures. So you must determine the frequency, and then you must put it in your written policies and procedures. Another issue we identified is that there is no evidence of review and approval of the marketing material. So verbal approval is not sufficient. There must be written evidence of the approval. We will require a record of the review and approval of the marketing material. Lastly, the rules, our interpretive notice requires training prior to creating, reviewing, and approving materials. We have seen cases where training was provided afterwards. So this ends our